Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. Studs Terkel was born on May 16, 1912. Last weekend, the University of Chicago hosted Let's Get Working, a three-day festival honoring the life and work of Studs Terkel. So we chose today to remember Studs and its huge contribution to documenting, frequently through the eyes of common folk, although he moved with the high rollers as well, the 20th century. He was on our program many times, and it's good to hear his voice again. We'll play a little clip of one of our interviews. Our guest this hour, Rick Ayers, met Studs in 1963 when Rick was a self-described high school suburban rebel. He was seeking freedom by turning the dial to the black music stations, discovering the beat of Bo Diddley in the heart of Aretha Franklin, and coming across WFMT, Chicago's fine arts radio station, where he would listen to Studs' interviews. They became instant and longtime friends through a chance meeting at the radio station, which Rick will talk about with us. And a listener let us know, too, there's a website now that WFMT is compiling all of those hours, and what a record it is. The people he interviewed, it's just a treasure of the 20th century, of politicians and movements and artists and books and theater and everything. I'm so glad to know that all of those interviews will soon be available. We'll give you that website as we talk this hour. So let's remember Studs. I know that he was on the show, and he's a big fan of this audience as well. So I'm sure you have memories and books that he wrote that were important to you and his life, his voice, worth remembering forever. So let's do our part. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Rick was born in Chicago. He's now an assistant professor of education at the University of San Francisco in the Urban Education and Social Justice Department. He taught in the Communication Arts and Sciences Small School at Berkeley High School, where he pioneered strategies for academic and social success for a diverse range of students. He is the author of great books for high school kids, as well as A Teacher's Guide to Studs Terkel's Working. And we're delighted to have Rick with us. Hello, Rick. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine. I think we had similar kinds of upbringings. We're probably roughly the same age, and after growing up in Hyde Park for a while in Des Plaines, I was a child of the Chicago suburbs about that time as well, although I didn't have the luxury and the pleasure of meeting Studs Terkel until years later.
Yes. Well, it was completely by accident.
It's a great story. Please tell it.
Well, I found myself in the middle of high school in a kind of, like as happened in the early 60s, in a kind of alienated, precocious little group of students who weren't interested in cheerleading and sports, but more interested in beat poetry. And so we used to listen to WFMT radio in Chicago, and one show, besides Studs, which we heard sometimes, was the Midnight Special, which was a fantastic kind of folk and blues roots show on Saturday night. So that was our Saturday night go-to radio show. Mm-hmm. So a group of friends and I went into the studio one time basically to drop off a Robert Johnson record, which was very rare, which we had discovered on one of those Northside records, and see if they'd like to play it. And Studs came out of his office going through the lobby as we were sitting there. I mean, we were basically 17 years old and having, our adventure of going to downtown Chicago. And, he came hustling out with his, armful of papers. And like Studs does, instead of rushing by and being too important for us, he did a double take. He saw these, 17-year-old white high school kids and said, "Hello, young people, what are you doing here? Why are you here?" And his curiosity always just led him to the next story and the next, which I'm still trying to learn from. And so he, you know, we explained a little about him. He says, oh, you're from Glen Ellen. We're from the west side, Glen Ellen. And he said, that's amazing. And so he immediately just sat down and took 10 minutes and chatted us up. And even at that moment, you feel kind of a reflected importance of yourself because he thinks you're so important, you know.
So
I always thought I was kind of worthless and unhappy. But he said, "Oh, you people are so interesting. You know, I want to know more about you." And he invited us in to do an interview the following week. Of course, we came, and so it's a very transformative experience just to meet him because, for one thing, he's not just searching for a story. He's always searching for the meaning of life.
Yes.
To get to the real fundamental stuff. And he imagines perhaps you have the answer for him. So suddenly you do feel like your little thoughts are worthwhile. So it was a lot of fun. And also he has an encyclopedic memory.
Oh, my goodness, did he have a memory.
Even
in his 90s, he could remember everything.
Yeah, and he would still say, you know, if he saw me again, he'd say, so how's Andy and how's his sister? And,
oh, my gosh.
You know, and so he was kept up with people. That was what he did.
I love the fact that you remember this so clearly, too. And when you talk about the number of friends that Studs had, he had thousands of friends. What he did for he did it for me, too, at an older age, but he made me feel, you know, good at my job, and he was a cheerleader for me, and I'm thinking, my gosh, this is coming from Studs Terkel. I feel great, you know. I'm charging ahead. Let's do more interviews. But when you talk about being a 17-year-old, that he looked at you and said, all of a sudden, you're pioneers, you're interesting. You can't imagine what that means to a teenager, and you've remembered it all these years later.
Definitely. And, you know, I've been a teacher for many years since then, and certainly try to remember that. Remember to find the beauty in every student and actually seek answers from them because they know things. And also to listen. Studs' number one skill was listening. He listened with his whole body. You know, I sometimes see interviewers on TV and they ask a question and you can see their mind wandering or perhaps a little gem is dropped and the interviewer just doesn't pick up on it, but simply goes to the next prepared question. And that's always frustrating. And no one quite does it like Studs, to be fully present
right. And
listening. So as a teacher, that's an important skill, too, to actually hear what's in front of you and not just continue delivering.
Fully present and interested, but also highly prepared. He read those books. He read the books. They were under.
He read the books.
Exactly,
he did. And so it wasn't just an interview. It was a conversation. It was an engaging conversation. And I've always been trying as a teacher, and it's something that a woman named Nancy Atwell developed in literacy work, too, is you have to engage students in a way that that is like a literary friend, where you're like a friend is. You're talking about their work, they're talking about the text, where they add something, you add something, and you jump into it. It's not just like, oh, that was a correct answer, or that was a good analysis, you know, like standing above the student like a judge. It's much more important that it induces better work if you just engage them like a friend, and that's how Studs does, and that's what I learned from him.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, probably one of his earliest books, and I know that a lot of high school students read this book now, Rick. I'm interested in your teacher's guide to Studs Terkel's working. Why have we picked up on that particular book, and what is your teacher's guide to that important work?
Well, actually, it was a funny thing that happened. I was teaching at Berkeley High School and had been doing some oral history work, and not only with Studs, but using Studs Terkel, but, you know, using some other great National Writing Project people to learn how to do oral history. And New Press, which publishes all of Studs' work, had put out a call. They had a little grant, and they wanted someone to write a teaching guide to working because, you know how it is. If you sell a teaching, one teaching guide, then you also sell, you know, 60 classroom sets of the book. So right. It's kind of a promotion thing. And I saw this request, and I started, I made a proposal, got accepted. I started writing it. It was supposed to be just a little, you know, 30-page fold-over pamphlet, and I just got carried away. And I talked to a lot of other teachers about it, and I ended up writing, you know, a 200-page book, which thankfully they decided to print and, you know, instill it in publication from New Press. But the thing that I did was really just take experiences of other teachers who had learned how to do oral history.
Oh.
But there's other things you do with it. For instance, how to study history using statistics, study the economy. Another thing is drama. People who are drama teachers or do drama have, many people have done this kind of Anna Deavere Smith type of activity where you go out and interview people. You learn to interview and listen. You take back the interviews and turn it into a play, say, about your community or about your school. And Anna Deavere Smith is famous for doing that in Twilight Los Angeles and also a play about Crown Heights. So anyway, I put all of this in this book, poured it into the book. Then I went and interviewed studs for the book, and I kind of transcribed with the interview and took it to him. And he grabbed it and sat there and edited it very fast. He said, "Oh, this isn't right. Let's change this. Okay, here." And so I got these pages and pages of handwritten edits from studs. So I also printed that to show how studs will take an interview and shape it. Because he was a great shaper. He did not simply report the Q and A. He very often, you know, he took this quote and that quote, whatever that would drive to his main point.
Right.
I printed that too. So anyway, it was a lot of fun doing, and then I end up being invited sometimes to talk about oral history. There's groups like Dave Eggers out in California has helped start a group called Voice of Witness, which does a lot of student work and publishes a lot of books of oral history. So oral history is alive and well, but definitely studs is the big daddy.
Yeah, he is the big daddy. It's a good way to describe him. He's the big daddy. And how generous of him to sit there and take his pen to your work and help you out with it, right?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was at his house, and he was just, you know, come on in, sit down. You know how it is.
Yeah, I know. He invited me. I just thought it was such an honor. He invited me right before he died. It was in the months before he died, and his publicist called and said, "Studs wants you to come to his house." And Studs want me to come to his house? I said, okay. So I figured I can't just enjoy this myself. So I invited my husband to go and my brother, who was in from the Netherlands. And we went to Studs' house. And, you know, he was dressed in his red checkered shirt and his red socks. And he wasn't feeling very well. But, man, he held court for a couple hours. And he was talking. And he knew how, Rick, to immediately key in on everybody's interest. So with my husband, he carried on this. My husband's a baseball guy, and a writer. So he zeroed in on the Boston Red Sox, Black Sox, 1919. Knew every darn player on the team. Talked about each person. I was floored. But also realized what he was doing. That he was looking at the interest of the people who were with him too.
Yeah, that's exactly what he does. He's not interested. You know, when you're at a party and there's someone who just tells about themselves, they're sort of a bore.
Oh yeah.
And if there's someone who asks about you, they seem so interesting.
Right.
He is definitely that guy who is outward focused. You know, he's definitely a social being, and it's a lot of fun to be with him.
Yeah. How do you explain, I've always wondered this about him, Rick, that we're living in even more partisan times right now where, people don't talk to each other because they don't agree with their politics and they don't like them and they don't have respect for them. There was Stutz was a pretty radical guy in a lot of various eras, and he lived a long time. So he would champion and write about people who other people might say are communists, you know, they're rabble-rousers, they're up to no good. But for some reason, even though he was blacklisted, he had this image of being this beloved human being. You know, even in the suburbs of Chicago, my mother loved Studs Terkel. A lot of people loved the man, even though he was pretty radical. How do you explain that?
Well, I think, you know, his brand of radicalism was not a kind of sectarian, attacking politics. He was a person who, if he was radical, or if he sort of favored the common man and woman, or favored the working class or the oppressed, it was really just a sort of deep humanism. Mm. And a deep humanism is easy to connect to. Mm-hmm. And also, he's fearless, you know. So you notice I keep speaking in the present.
I know.
I can't do past tense. I'm sorry.
I know. I'm with you.
Because he seems so present. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he's fearless, so he doesn't mind, you know, even like the FBI guy who comes to his door, and, you know, most people would slam the door or shake in their boots, and he'd be like, okay, come in, I want to know what you're all about, you know. And so
right.
He's disarming in that way, and he is genuinely interested in finding common ground, which, yes, you're right, in the current era, that's not very common.
Yeah. Rick Ayers, our guest this hour. We're remembering Studs Terkel, who is worth talking about always. His body of work is really phenomenal. We interviewed him many times on his books. Will the Circle Be Unbroken? I want to talk to Rick about that. I know when my mom died, I read every page of that book. I had read it before, but I've given it to people too, because the experience of death was something he wondered about after his wife died. And I think that that's a very powerful, important book for when we're going through the grieving process. What can I read? I found that to be so helpful. And all his other books, working, people talk about what they do all day and how they feel about what they do. Books on race, how blacks and whites think and feel about the American obsession. Hope Dies Last, one of his later books, Keeping the Faith in Troubled Times. The Good War, an oral history of World War II. Hard Times, an oral history of the Great Depression, a very important book. And Rick was interviewed about his father, and that made it into that book. We'll talk about that. Division Street America, American Dreams Lost and Found, and many other books as well. Feel free to join our reminiscing this hour of the program. We're doing this today for a couple reasons. One, tomorrow would have been his 102nd birthday. University of Chicago had a major conference on Studs Terkel last week, bringing together a number of people from all kinds of disciplines to remember his life. And because it's a worthwhile thing to do, too. So here's our number if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Rick was born in Chicago. He is an assistant professor of education at the University of San Francisco in the Urban Education and Social Justice cohort. He has taught at the Communication Arts and Sciences Small School at Berkeley High School, and he is the author of a number of books, including great books for high school kids, as well as A Teacher's Guide to Studs Terkel's Working, and is co-author with his brother Bill Ayers of Teaching the Taboo, Courage and Imagination in the Classroom. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Studs Terkel, remembering his extraordinary life this hour, this day before what would have been his 102nd birthday, and welcoming phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Rick Ayers, his friend, is our guest this hour. We go to Greg in Bayview next. Hi, Greg.
Yes, I have recently participated in the Bayview tragedy commemoration, and I started to do some more reading about that. And Lucy Parsons' husband, Albert, was a victim of the Haymarket tragedy frame-up But she lived until 1942. Did Studs Terkel know Lucy Parsons, and anything to say about her?
I can tell you, Greg, yes, he did know Lucy Parsons. I remember, actually, he brought her up, and he knew the Haymarket story inside and out. Now, whether there's writing, I'd have to Google that, whether there's anything he actually wrote about her or whether he actually interviewed her. But, yes, she was a Chicago personality, and he made a point of knowing her. That's all I know so far.
Well, the story I have is that when Lucy Parsons died in a house fire, mm-hmm. her writings disappeared that evening.
Whoa.
I wonder if Studs Terkel had any of her writings that may have survived that fire.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There is a big Studs Terkel archive, and it's going to be a big job to go through it with the Chicago Historical Society, WFMT. And there's actually a biography being written right now by Alan Weider called Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, but Mostly Conversation. Mm. And he is pouring through the archives, and he interviewed me and everyone else. And I'll actually ask Alan, there may be some things that he was given by her, and that's an interesting lead, interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll see what I can uncover.
And, Greg, if you want to send us an email of some kind, we'll get your addresses in sync, okay?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. He interviewed you about your father, didn't he, was it Hard Times?
Yes, for Hard Times. Really, he interviewed my father was the most important thing. My father was the president of Commonwealth Edison. So, and Todd was very funny about it because he was kind of nervous, or he acted nervous, because he was like, Commonwealth Edison is a sponsor of WFMT, and I don't want to get in trouble here. He was afraid that he would, kind of get WFMT in trouble. So he didn't, but on the other hand, he wanted to get his story. So, but in the end, I made the introduction. And my father was very gracious and liked Studs very much, of course. And then Studs interviewed me, and he interviewed my brother Bill. And I actually look back. It's just a couple of paragraphs. I look back at that. I think it's disguised as a character named Baird, an industrialist in the Northwest. But it's really my dad. But the truth can now be told.
I guess so.
All the principles have passed.
Yeah,
but I look back at what I said and I kind of cringe because I think I was, a bit of a young smartass and did not really give my father credit. I think we were still at odds in the '60s and became a lot closer later. I mean, I didn't trash him, but I don't feel great about that piece. Somewhere in these archives that Alan's pouring through is also, of course, the transcript of this interview with my friends and me. So I really hope he finds that.
I'm sure. Well, I'm so happy that all of those interviews, think of the incredibly important, marvelous historical interviews he did with so many people, Rick.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be on tape. They'll be there forever, right?
Yeah, definitely. The thing is, he worked with some people like Sidney Lewis and others who were very, very thorough in helping keep the archive together. So he did interview the famous, and he often has some of the best interviews with well-known people and well-known, of course, musicians. He was really big in the jazz scene.
Mm-hmm.
He himself actually kind of brought Mahalia Jackson to the public, and the kind of gospel singing that was one of the unknown hearts of Chicago culture, and so she always credits him. But of course, Studs is famous for talking to the common people too,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I actually still my favorite book. I have to say, my favorite book of his is Division Street America.
Mm-hmm.
It was a breakthrough idea. It was interviewing everyone in Chicago from all walks of life. And I just think it kind of changed how we think of our world.
Yeah. Well, this might be a good time to hear a little bit of Studs. I interviewed him several times on several of his books, and we can't talk about Studs with hearing a little bit of his voice today. This is just a small portion of an interview that was done after the release of his book, And They All Sang, which featured more than 40 of his conversations with some of the great music legends of the 20th century. And one of the interviews that he talks about, so we're talking about his remembering one of his interviews, was with Leonard Bernstein. And when you listen to this, listen to it, if you don't mind me telling you how to listen to it, listen to it in terms of he's not only describing Leonard Bernstein, he's also, in a way, although he wouldn't say this, talking about Studs. So I was thinking about he could have been talking about himself. It could have been another note to himself. This interview was from some years ago, Studs Terkel on the book, And They All Sang.
You see, I'm so happy you mentioned Bernstein. That interview with him was, I had to cut it, but I hope I saved the heart of it. That interview with him was full of such generosity of spirit.
Yeah,
he spoke about the man he admired so much, Mark Blitzstein,
mm-hmm.
who wrote that very controversial WPA folk opera, The Cradle of Rock, at the movie Tim Robbins made. But mostly, the title comes from him, And They All Sang. The subtitle is Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey, because Bernstein said way back, he's not opposed to technology. He believes in everything that helps men and women enrich their lives. But with more and more technology, there's less contact with the human voice. He says, and they all sang. That's his quote. He says, in the olden days, everybody sang. He expected to sing as well as talk. It was a mark of the cultured man or woman. To sing, to know music. And so my hearing isn't very good. I assume that was part of West Side Story.
Yes, it was, Studs.
Yeah, I assume that. You realize he could write almost anything.
Yeah.
He sort of helped revolutionize musical comedy. It's not. It's more than that. Or Candide. But isn't that? It's his openness, the humor.
Mm-hmm.
He saw jazz as important. And he said, what would America be like? What would the United States be like? Were there no jazz? Or what would jazz be like if there were no African-American people here? But he would talk about any subject you want. And then I happened to mention The Cradle Will Rock by Mark Blitzstein, a composer he admired very much. And then he starts singing from it. And he says to me, how do you know it? I says, I was in it. I was in a Chicago company. He said, what role? And he guessed I was doing Editor Daily. And we both sang. We both were terrible, of course. But he knew every song from it. His memory. And he also talked about the phony patriotic songs. And what a real song of the American spirit. But the talk with him was sort of an adventure.
That was about less than 2 minutes long, and what he had to say in a two-minute period of time was just so filled with so much great stuff, wasn't it, Rick?
Yeah. I mean, he could, he started calling up names and composers and who made the movie already in his old age. He could do the same thing about Plato and Aristotle and Dante.
Right.
He was classically widely read. He could tell. If you said Ibsen, well, he had a lot to say about Henrik Ibsen. You know, whatever. He knew it. Paul Robeson.
Mm-hmm. And when I think of his, and that's a long time to be in radio, 46 years. And when he was talking about the contact with a human voice and how important that is, I mean, that's why he loved the medium. That's why he was so good at it. Plus, he was so knowledgeable. But that contact with a human voice, it will, I think, remain forever important.
Yes. Exactly. I think you're right.
Mm.
And you have to see, I mean, okay, so Division Street, which was his second, he'd done the Giants of Jazz before. Division Street comes out in 63. This was the same time that new journalism was really taking off. It was when readers began to distrust the sort of white male voice of authority, you know, the the lead New York Times reporter who will tell you what's happening in Vietnam. And, you know, we came to distrust that. We came to feel like, oh, these people are lying. And same with historians, you know, the male historian who will write a narrative that says this is what happened. And a whole new kind of narrative was being developed, which is more personal, more saying this is what I think, this is where I see things from my standpoint. And, you know, you're allowed the I pronoun in that kind of journalism, but it's more honest, and the reader can take into account your point of view instead of pretending there's some fake objectivity. Well, Studs was in the center of that movement. You know, we think of Joan Didion and Hunter Thompson as new journalists, but Studs was saying, you know, the multiple voices and the voices from the bottom, that's real history.
Right. Don't you miss Chicago?
I do miss Chicago. Yeah. I'm talking. I'm like, what am I doing? I don't miss the weather, but right. I miss it.
It's a good city. Yeah, it's a good city. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi, Rick, Kathleen, thanks for the program. Chicago is still there, by the way. You don't have to miss it.
Oh, thank goodness.
Okay. You can
okay.
see it. I just called to say I think of Studs Terkel as the anti-pollster of America. And by that, I mean we live in this culture where people are always trying to draw out the aggregate opinion or trend or whatever. And I told your screener, he was the guy in America who, if he had heard a commercial that said 9 out of 10 New York doctors recommend this product, he would say, I want to talk to the 10th doctor. he had that angle or that sense of humor on reality that is so rare that even with Mahalia Jackson, if you listen to the story he told about Mahalia Jackson in terms of how on her radio program, when he was asked to sign a loyalty oath, she said, you don't have to sign that. You just go and tell them they'll have to find another Mahalia. Mm-hmm. And he had recognized very early on there's only one Mahalia Jackson.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that is such a wonderful point because what you're saying too is we're in a time of these kind of bogus metrics which seem to dominate everything. And as an educator, I'm driven nuts by these this obsession with standardized tests, which really narrow the curriculum and dumb it down. But Studs would never accede to that these numbers describe the value of a student. He was all about the qualitative, you know, complex look at each person rather than these kind of silly metrics.
Hmm. And you used to go out to lunch with him, and you never knew where you were going.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, I mean, he was known everywhere, you know, and so... you know, it could be a little deli, or it could be sort of a showbiz posh spot. And you know, I went to lunch with him sometimes. I wish I'd gone to lunch with him more, but he always got around. You know, we brought him to American Education Research Association when he was quite old. I think he was 91, and my job was to get him there to this conference in downtown Chicago, which I picked him up and got him there. And he insisted on taking the bus home because he has a bus line he likes to take. And I was very nervous.
I'm sure.
I dropped him off, so then I lurked around the corner and watched him to make sure he didn't fall or get lost, because he was really – and he was chatting up everyone in the bus stop. I watched him get on, chat up the bus driver. You know, that's what he wanted to do. He didn't want me to just drive him home.
No.
He wanted to have another Chicago adventure.
Yeah. And when he talks about it on Hear So Well, I'm reminded that I was interviewing him a long time ago when he didn't hear so well. By the time we got to the last interview, he wasn't hearing at all, but it made no difference at all. Because he'd get one of the words that I had used, and I think that we were in sync so much that he assumed that what I had asked was indeed what I had asked.
Right.
So I just let him fly. You know, I figured, what the heck? This voice is worth hearing. I don't care if he heard another question or not. Let him roll.
Exactly. Well, we were trying to get him to write, do this one writing project when he was 92, And he said, well, Bill, Rick, I'm not sure I can make it. You know, I'm on a deadline. And I said, what's the deadline? He said, I'm the deadline. I'm 92 years old. You know, so he kept his sense of humor.
Yeah, he did. Thanks, Rich, very much for the call. Kathy in Pewaukee. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. And I didn't have time to go back and look and see what year it was, but I think either 33 or 34 years ago, Studs was the featured guest at Manchester College in North Manchester, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And my husband was on the faculty, and we were at a reception for Studs. And somehow or other, he found out that I was an elected official, that I had been elected to the town board. And that was at a time when there were not a lot of women that were elected to things. And so he was very interested in that and talked for quite a while. I think I did okay talking to him. And it was after we were finished that I had the shakes because I realized then how important that had been.
So, yes.
I don't know that it ever made it into any of his writing, but it certainly made an impression on me.
That's a great story, Kathy. That's he must have done that all over, taking people. Well, look what he did with you when you were 17, just taking people aside. Hey, let's go get a microphone. Let's talk about this. That's really extraordinary.
Yes. And he would always say, I'm fussing with this machine. I don't know if I can work
right.
It.
Right, you know, yes. Did he say that to you, too? Right.
He said it to everyone. It was part of his way to make you feel more relaxed.
Right.
But that's beautiful. Manchester, Indiana, I can hear your Midwest accent. It's making me homesick.
Oh. Well, come on back to Chicago. You should have been at the event over the weekend.
Yes.
You know? Yes. But there'll be more.
I wanted to be there. I was out of the country.
Oh.
At another conference, but I had hoped to be there. But some of my friends from Voice of Witness were there. So it's great.
Yeah. Thank you, Kathy, so much for your call. Let's go to Jim in Oregon, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
Listen, I grew up on the near north side of Chicago, not far from, speaking of Division Street, USA, from Division Street. But across the alley from me, and unfortunately I was too young to know him, but was none other than Nelson Algren.
Oh, sure.
And we do have a copy of his Man with the Golden Arm, and he autographed it for my mother. You know, to a good neighbor, best wishes, you know, Nelson Algren, that kind of business. But I did call Studs once back in the 70s. I learned about WFMT when I was going to Loyola in Chicago.
Right.
And somebody turned me on to, because, you know, we were always listening to Larry Lujack, WLS, that kind of
thing.
Yes. I'm sure Mr. Ayers remembers that. And but I talked to him, and he says, and the first thing he said to me, he says, well, young man, you know, you show very good taste. So once immediately disarming me, making, as you say, making you feel good about yourself.
Yes.
And then occasionally I would see Mel Zellman. He used to be one of the announcers for WFMT, but he's also the announcer for the concerts that were in Grant Park, and I would sometimes talk to him after intermission and things like that, and he would say, you should come and see Studs and talk to him about Nelson Algren. And now, you know, and I never did, and I wish I had, but I listened to so many of the interviews, and especially one of the things I recall as a kid, probably 5 years old, was hearing Mahalia Jackson. Now, my old man was going to work, and he worked the night shift in a plastics factory. But he had the television on as he was getting ready, and he says, that's Mahalia Jackson. That's Mahalia Jackson. I'm assuming the show was Studs Place. Do you know anything about that, Mr. Ayers? Is that a possibility, just as an aside?
Well, you mentioned Studs Place, and yeah, Studs Place was an amazing kind of mixture of a of a sitcom and a variety show. So it was, Studs was behind the lunch counter and people would come in. And I have only seen little cuts from it. Someone's got to rescue that stuff. It's on tape. But yes, she was definitely on it. I remember him talking about bringing her on it because that was one of the places he hoped to expose her to the public. So yes, That was a great kind of. This is early TV. Kukla, Fran, and Ollie was on, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of shows that were local and that were very spontaneous, and I think we've lost that mostly in television, but that was a real classic.
You're right.
Good idea.
Somebody should resurrect that along with all the radio interviews.
Yeah.
That would
exactly.
be a very good thing to do.
Yeah, and Nelson Algren was one of his number one heroes. So it's interesting you bring it up. He often, if you're talking Chicago arts, he would always find a way to bring it back to Nelson Algren.
I remember being taught by Nelson Algren's wife, whose first name I can't remember, who was teaching sort of voice training at the University of Iowa in the speech department. And she would smoke, this shows you how long ago it was, she would smoke cigarettes, Rick, and she dragged on them so hard, and the smoke never came out again. And I'd sit there in class the whole hour wondering, what the heck happened to all the smoke?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Jim, thank you so much for the call. Our phone number, we're reminiscing this hour. Tomorrow would have been Studs Terkel's birthday. He was born in 1912, lived a good life, but, I hope he lives forever, and I think that he will because he was an extraordinary man. And our guest this hour is Rick Ayers. He was a friend of Studs Terkel's. He is a professor in teacher education at the University of San Francisco. He first met Studs in 1963 when he was a high school student, a suburban rebel, met him in the lobby of WFMT just by chance, and they became lifelong friends. So we're talking about Studs Terkel. And here's how you can reach us if you would like to do so. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter. And that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking about Studs Terkel this hour of the program with Rick Ayers, who was a friend of his and, his bio, too. For a long time, they were friends. Welcoming calls. Again, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Have you read his Will the Circle Be Unbroken book, Rick?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. That book has been so meaningful to me on so many occasions. Has it to you?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, it's funny. I just finished writing a book that's in press that's called A Death in the Family, Teaching Through Tears. And it's about what teachers do or can do when students die.
Oh.
Sadly, we all have this experience. Oh. Every teacher I know has lost a student, not only how we mourn, but how do we help the class get through it. So I definitely turn to that book for wisdom in some terrible experiences I've had with, you know, too many young people are dying with gun violence in this country. And sometimes being a teacher is not just reading and writing. Sometimes it's helping a class negotiate that.
Mm-hmm.
And, Studs is one of the, you know, he doesn't make it simple. There's no simple how-to. There's no formula. And I really appreciate that, keeping it as complex as it is, you know.
Right. That must be a hard book to have written, the one you did.
I hesitated for about 10 years that I had to do it because, you know, people go through teacher ed and we never discuss it, but it is
right.
something you can experience. So.
Yeah.
It's something I'm working on.
And I remember his saying to me that of all the interests he had, of all the things that absorbed him and that he learned about, I don't know if it was a fear of death, which, you know, I fully understand. I got one. But he just didn't have the same kind of curiosity until his wife died. And then it was time to look at it.
Yes, exactly. No, he definitely loved her dearly There is no, as he says, and as I've learned, there's no closure. There's no getting over it. It just does become further in the past. And I think he is able to sit with the pain of it without being consumed by it or immobilized. But it is a very very, very difficult. And he reminds me, too, that while he was a raconteur in the life of the party, he was not facile or shallow, you know. And
right.
he could suffer and suffer seriously and let you in on it, which I think is another part of his generosity.
Oh, that's interesting. How is it that he became, you know, it's so famous on a big level, too? I mean, he's way beyond Chicago, and yeah. It's not as though he had a big commercial success. He was on public TV and, you know, public radio. It wasn't this huge kind of audience, but people found him. How did he get found by so many people?
Well, again, I think it was the man and the times coming together, because we were, as I was saying, we were in a time where a lot of the way narrative was done and the way stories were told in our society was being shaken up. You know, people weren't trusting the master narrative. And I think he just came along at a time when he could be catapulted. I think he did an amazing job at the New Press of helping them to get these books out. It's a small press. It's not really. It's a non-profit press.
Is it?
And he, you know, instead of going with Macmillan or something, he stuck with this press and helped keep them going. I just think people were hungry for it, and he was that big a personality. And you're right. It points out that sometimes, if you tend your garden well, right where you are, you will be discovered. You don't have to go out and go to Washington, D.C., you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would imagine, Rick, that he created so much and gave us really so much history as well, that all of those books are going to be valuable for so many people for a long, long time, don't you think?
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. And people continue to try to emulate and successfully emulate some of this kind of historiography and work. And so, you know, he's really, and that's what was demonstrated at this University of Chicago conference. You know, he represents kind of a shift in the whole genre of nonfiction writing. So, you know, he was a really important person. I also think, you know, this was the protest generation. It was the 60s.
Right.
And there are very few people who gave that story back to us in such a deep and complex way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hate the media stories of the 60s that are like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You know, it was all so fun. And I think we need historians to rescue the real complex story of it, and the story of everyone's lives, not just student protesters, but, you know, people who worked in the plastics factory on the midnight shift. You know, that's who was studying.
Yeah.
You could find the story.
He often said, he probably said it to you, that one thing was for certain, curiosity wasn't going to kill that cat. And and it's true that he, thank God, he lived such a long period of time, because he was able to document all of these, you know, the Depression era.
Yeah.
That's important. It was, I'm drawn to that era, to our parents' generations, too. So all of these generations, all of these civil rights movement, and to see all of that with eyes that were really seeing what was going on and taking it in a very deep fashion. Thank God for his life, for his long life.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, he not only did that for the Depression, he also, that whole piece about World War II.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, he called it the Good War kind of tongue-in-cheek, and he made fun. You know, he was very critical of this this term, the Greatest Generation, that Tom Brokaw gave to the World War II generation, because he felt like it romanticized and simplified the experience of World War II. So it's almost like the Good War was a response to the Greatest Generation.
Oh. Well, I can see why you two were friends. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been just a great hour. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Come on back to Chicago.
Okay, I'll visit.
All right. Rick Ayer is our guest, a good friend of Studs Terkel, and we spent this hour the day before Studs' birthday remembering his life. And a lot of people are doing that. If you go to our Facebook page, too, a listener, thank you for doing this, gave us a link to the WFMT project that's doing an archive of his vast body of work, which is a really good place to go. So our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. It's being done by WFMT. Rick is a professor in teacher education at the University of San Francisco. He received his PhD at UC Berkeley Graduate School of Education, and he has written a number of books. One of his books is on teaching, working to students, one of Studd's earlier books. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. Thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in sunny downtown Milwaukee. Thank you for listening. We'll be with you next on Monday.